The following talk was given by Steve Hagen on June 15, 2024. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's good to see you.
What I thought I would talk about is, in some ways, that what I was talking about last night, which I won't get into, and it won't be necessary for you to know that now. But I thought it might be nice to see if we can make some connection with some of our teachings. And one that came to mind and that I thought I'd talk about would be the just the opening lines of the Xin Qing Ming, if you're familiar with that teaching. Xin Qing Ming, which is trusting heart-mind. I've seen it poorly translated in other ways, like believing in the heart mind or something like this, and other things as well. It's not belief, it's trust. It's confidence in heart mind. And that was written by the third patriarch of Zen in China, Zhenzong, two generations after Bodhidharma. And so it's a very early teaching in Zen. But it opens like this. Just give you some opening lines, and then maybe I'll talk about them, these opening lines, and in some ways maybe relate them to things that I spoke of last night. Anyway, it opens like this. The great way is not difficult. There is nothing it prefers. Only when you neither love nor hate does it appear clearly without disguise. A hair's breadth of difference and heaven and earth are set apart. If you wish to see it, then hold no opinions, either for or against. To set what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. Not knowing the profound quality of the way, we disturb our original peace of mind to no purpose. For those of you who were there last night, I don't know if you have a sense, but I'll try to bring it out that this relates very much to everything I was talking about last night. But let's just go into this a bit. This opening line, the great way has no difficulties. Or did I say is not difficult? Yeah, that's not either way. But the second, these lines are couplets. And in the second line, though, it's often translated as, and you might know it this way, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And if you look at the Chinese, it really doesn't quite put it that way. References to you, or to those, or self, or me, These aren't going to be showing up. And if you just look at the Chinese, you don't see those. Those are kind of inserted by people later on, maybe to help clarify what Zhenzong is saying here. But and it clarifies in the sense that, yeah, that makes more sense to me. Okay. Because when you say the great way is not difficult, there is nothing it prefers. Well, it never occurred to me that the way would be something that would have preferences anyway. So. But when you say it is not difficult for those, this could include me now, for those who have no preferences. And while that's not wrong to say it that way, that isn't what Zhenzong really put there. Because he's saying something far more subtle than that. And while we might dismiss it as, who's that would think the great way would have difficulties? And there's nothing about what's this it that it would have preferences anyway. So it's kind of like a throwaway line there in a way. Whereas if we say it's not difficult for those who don't, who have no preferences. Okay, now I have it. But as I was talking about last night a bit, as soon as we put something there that we can grasp, me, or those people who don't have preferences, then this way wouldn't be difficult. Yeah, and again, as I said, it isn't that that's wrong exactly, except that where are you going to get hold of those anyway? Who are they? And does that include you? Well, who are you? What does you refer to? What does I, me, what do these words refer to? This is drawing, to interpret it that way, is to draw upon an assumption that we all have, that we all make, without really examining it. That we, if you don't question, well, what is me? Well, when we use that word me, and I use it too in our everyday parlance, we have to. It's the way English is structured, but it's also in these worlds, this world of conceptual thought, it works, it functions. But it also obscures that if you look very carefully at the direct experience of this moment, what is taking place now, we don't find a referent. What is it referring to? Me? I? If you look at these, I mean, we use these words all the time without even thinking about it. And of course, then, yes, we do have a sense of self. So I'm referring to me, you know, my sense of myself. You know. And we keep ourselves locked in this way of thinking or seeing or understanding the world and of our experience, not realizing that, say, when a Tsen Tsang comes along and has his opening line, and it isn't, it isn't a throwaway line like that. He's saying something quite profound. It is that the way itself, reality, truth, wholeness, totality, it has no preferences. There's no preferences in its wholeness and totality. And it's this wholeness, this totality, which is the actual vibrancy of what we might otherwise call life, or just being here in this world and experiencing what appears to be moment by moment by moment by moment. But as soon as we insert preference, that's very characteristic of acting out of this sense of me, separate and apart from others, other people, but other things or thoughts or beliefs or ideas. And now, as I was talking about last night, there's the setup for fighting and squabbling and just instability of mind, all of this. Torment, pain, fear, longing and loathing. So as soon as we put some, but what Tsen Tsang is trying to draw our attention, what these enlightened teachers are trying to draw our attention to, is that this great way is not like that. It isn't a thing. It was just this, just thus, I was speaking of last night a bit. I get making some gesture there. Because what are we going to say? I think what we can say is not anything about what it is. We can just say it isn't nothing. This is not nothing. People will misinterpret that word or other words like shunyata or emptiness, or sometimes called voidness. Gets translated in English very often as nothingness. No, this is Nagarjuna now. It's not nothing. This is not nothing. Something seems to be taking place here. I was going to say something is going on here, but actually we can't say that either, because you'll never get hold of, well, what is that something? And of course we'll do that. Well, so what? And we keep searching. Then we get other ideas and we'll find, well, this is here, that is here. And I'm here. All of this. But we never really notice that we never get hold of anything there. What? What is here? What am I? Of course, when it comes to an I, we'd say, who am I? Yeah, but we can still say, what? What are we talking about? Once in a while, these kinds of thoughts or questions might arise in our minds, but generally, if they do, they don't stick around too long, and we just go on with our daily living, never realizing that much of what we're saying and doing is in a world that really, well, doesn't seem to have any substantiality to it whatsoever. And this is what the enlightened are pointing out to us and saying the great way. So this great way, then what is that again? Well, that is this, just this such, thus. Here it is. As my teacher used to say, here it is. What is it? And of course, that's it's not even a rhetorical question. It's just, it's less than that, but it's just a matter of, yeah, you put the what there. And of course, we might try to answer that. I did at first, until I realized this is just to help me or any of us to really question that. What? Yeah, here it is in all its vibrancy. You touch it and hear it and taste it. But we can also think it and feel it, whether it's a feeling of the heart or pain in the knee, whatever it might be. All these experiences, rich and wonderful as they are, seemingly coming and going, changing. You know, some are wonderful and others are more frightening, more sorrowful, or any number of ways. It's just this richness of this unfolding. Just this, just us. This is totality. This is the great way. But it is without preference. There's nothing it prefers. So if we say that the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences, yeah, sure, yeah. If you have no preferences, yeah, we can say you, yeah. But what is it that has these no preferences? To the extent that we can, in our own minds, settle down into this kind of a living out of no preference. I spoke of this in a slightly different way last night, but with this, it's the way that we can realize this or experience it is in just simply watching our own mind and noticing when our mind is tending toward this, away from that, and it's leaning in one way or another. I spoke of this in my book, Buddhism Plain and Simple, quite a bit. I mean, I pointed it out in a number of places. And we can notice when we're tending to go this way, we're tending to go that way, think that this would be better, I like this, I don't like that. Just watch for that. Because in engaging this is a world of pain and sorrow. It's a world of confusion and not understanding. It's a world full of terrors and fears, but also, of course, you have joys as well. But the joyfulness is still there with wholeness. But when we get into the fractured world, and we think that the world is really substantially just that way, with the this and the that and the broken parts and pieces, and we're tossed about by all of these, or we're trying to arrange them in a better arrangement. All of that, living out of preference and interpreting everything according to how I'd like to see it or feel it, we'll do that even without really realizing what we're doing. But this is not to follow the great way. So it is just simply to realize that this, whatever's... We can't, there's nothing to say here, but just simply thus, in totality, is without preference. And why would that be? Well, it's because it's totality, it's wholeness, it's completeness. We're talking about reality in it as a whole. There's nothing outside of this. Even now as we sit here, we think, well, yes, but there's this vast universe. As I pointed out last night, yeah, now we have scientists, physicists, mathematicians who are right on the brink, well, they're not on the brink, they've proven that actually space and time themselves are illusions. There isn't really space or time, you know. So this vastness of the universe and all of that. Well, how vast is it if there isn't even space or time? But of course, there appears to be space and there appears to be time. And the awakened don't deny this. They'll even call that truth or reality, but they would. at least we can now here, and those of us who speak languages that are alphabetical or whatever, as opposed to, say, in Chinese or whatever, we can just simply capitalize words like truth or reality. Unless we're speaking of ordinary, everyday understanding and manipulating of reality, smaller reality. The enlightened, they don't deny this, because these are the appearances of our life. And we need to take care of these things. But it is helpful if we could realize that ultimately that isn't really what's taking place here. Of course, then we want to know, well then, what is really taking place here? Well, this is just it. You can't get hold of that. We can realize this, just this, thus, but we can't get a hold of it in any way. We can't characterize it in any way, because then it becomes this thing set off and apart from everything else. And again, our everyday life seems to be nothing but this thing set apart and all of that, and we're obsessed with this in various ways, or frightened by it, or struggling to get ahead over here, or whatever, and all the things that that entails. And the fighting and the warring and all the stuff that goes on in life. That's what that is. That's where this comes from. But it's from without really realizing that actually what we have is empty. All of that, these appearances are empty of any kind of substantiality or ultimate realness. They're real enough, though, that we can easily get caught up in these things, and we can easily injure ourselves or others in various ways, either deliberately or accidentally. And so the enlightened don't deny this world of pain and sorrow and giddiness and whatever else it might contain, moment by moment, coming and going. So we can't really deny this. But we can see that it lacks the kind of endurance or permanence or substance that we might otherwise give it. So just reminding us in that this truth in its totality, it's not difficult. Because preferences, there's a lot of difficulty. But it's not difficult. There's nothing it prefers. It doesn't prefer anything over another. But we will prefer one thing over another. And that's a feeling, and that's perfectly fine, normal, even. But we don't need to act out of these with the intensity that we might otherwise do. I have to stop this. I have to get that. I have to show how you're wrong about what you think about. Look at the political scene we got today. All of these kinds of things are not necessary if what our concern is to wake up. Just to really understand the nature of what's unfolding here, which isn't even really unfolding, because without space or time, but there's the appearance of unfolding. So we don't say there's no unfolding. It's just that we can't really say that there is, even. You can't really say that there is anything in the end. At the same time, obviously, this is not nothing. It's not that. These are called the extremes. One version of what we might call the extremes of something or nothing. And then we have that deep philosophical question, why is there something rather than nothing? I remember when I first encountered that. I don't know, was I a teenager? In my 20s anyway, at least. And I thought, that's that's pretty deep. And I used to think about that. But eventually, and through studying this way, but also just practicing and learning to pay attention, and without running off with ideas or emotional reactions or whatever, and just staying with this. I have a deep desire, because I want to know what's going on. This was me as a young person. But at some point, then I could see the lack of substantiality of this. And yet at the same time, here it is, and you cannot deny that. But it's not here in the way that we otherwise might have naively thought, or as I certainly did, we all do. There really is a chair here, by golly. I can touch it, I can feel it, I can see it, I can hear it when it rattles on the floor there. But and that's pretty compelling, pretty convincing. And the away might say, no, but that's wrong. You know, well, just take another look. Yeah, yes, it certainly seems to be real, seems to be here, seems to be persisting in time, all of this. But if we continue to observe these things, and observe also your own mind and your emotional or intellectual graspable reaction or sense of all this, or your desire to figure it out, stuff like this, none of that is necessary. But just observe all of these things. At some point, we can realize, as Sen Tsang says there, the great way is not difficult. There's nothing it prefers. We can understand why that would be the case. So he goes on, he says, only when you neither love nor hate. Yeah. So we can just appreciate what is taking place here. We don't have to hate. Look at all the kind of loving and hating that's going on in our society today in this political year. It's very frightening for a lot of us, what's going on. I don't know how this is going to go. No time at all to be totally carried away by that. But I'd love to have this take place. I'd hate that. And these things are very powerful. But if we realize what is taking place here in totality, it isn't that one is good, one is bad, one is evil, and one is good again, I guess. These are, again, the appearances. And, of course, missteps here and all of that can bring a lot of pain, a lot of sorrow. Could even drive us into killing and injuring, all sorts of things, or even tearing down some of the wonderful structures that we are capable of doing. Even just simple things like creating rules for the road as we drive. If we didn't have these things, driving would be very difficult. Even in Duluth, you get down into the cities or all the east in the big cities, everything would come to a halt if we didn't have rules of the road. Everybody's just driving what side of the road, which way do you turn it, you can imagine, it'd be gridlock in no time. And dangerous accidents and things. So we do need these things in this world of this and that. But we will take them too far, too seriously. And we'll try to use our ideas about what is right and good to set up the world to make sure it goes our way here. And now this is where the difficulty is coming from. The great way itself is without difficulty. Just remember that. Bring yourself back to that. Look at this again. Maybe there's a different way we can act and we can carry out things. At least at the personal level, perhaps. Yeah, and I can say personal level, even though the person, we don't know, do we? But still, we can understand that level, as we might call it, or other levels of higher, more societies that involve more and more people and that sort of thing. So it's a matter of just really standing back and looking at these things. The moment you love or you hate, now you've grasped, you're taking hold of something, and you're going to try to drive it in ways and shape things out of it. That even if we think, I'm doing this for the good of all of us, to help us and build a good, stable, fair society. Yeah, right. But even out of our good actions, if we insist, we force them through, this might not be so good. And I gave this story last, for those of you there, the man on the bus. Eventually he calmed down the entire and war was about to break out. But he wasn't showing any kind of preferences or whatever. He was just taking care of this very intense but threatening moment that was happening, and could bring everybody together and to realize that they were about to embark on an insane path here, and it's not necessary. It's really never necessary. The skill or the ability might be in just to try to help people see where they're going. So we do have this simple teaching. I use it a lot. It was just simply, watch your mind. You might think, well, watch my mind. Okay, so that doesn't... No, it's just watch your mind. Not so that anything. But in watching your mind, you'll realize what you're engaged with. Eventually, you realize that this is your life. It's not just all of that out there, what it might do and what I need to do. Right from the very start, this is your life. But as soon as we try to take hold of it in one way or another, even with good intentions and want to fix this up, be very careful, because this is how we get bound up in confusion and pain and suffering. And we got our righteous way. Yeah, we know that this is certainly much better than what you're advocating over there. You know, here we go again. So this is this might be difficult at first. And it is for, if you feel like, well, Steve is saying, I got to drop this or I got to drop that. And well, you can't exactly do that. But you can watch your mind. And when you start to see what these things are and how we can easily get bound and up in confusion and pain and suffering, then we can learn to just let go. My teacher, Katagiri Roshi, this is what he told me one time. He said, what I've learned is how to keep my hands off. That's kind of like the great lesson that he learned ultimately, to not try to control everything or whatever. Well, what was I was going through those lines, wasn't it? There's more in there. Let's see. Yes, and then in not doing that, getting carried away by this or that, it appears clearly. At some point in this will appear, this gray way, this totality, this wholeness, appears clearly. It's not as an object or an idea or a philosophy or anything like this. There's nothing you can say about it. But here it is, and we can realize its nature. You know, and so it appears very clearly. As soon as we grasp, you know, we have teachings like this too, as Zen masters say, yeah, as soon as you take hold of something here, as soon as you stir your mind, immediately you're lost in confusion. Immediately. We'll give that some consideration. Of course, we do need to stir our minds to some degree, just getting along in the world here today. You know, I was asked to come here and give a talk today, and so I responded, and I needed to stir my mind. You were stirring your mind to some degree, however it was that you approached me. Yeah, so it isn't like these things are bad or evil, and we don't ever do this. But if you stir your mind in such a way where you're trying to grasp it, particularly when we get to this place, we're trying to, what is this? What is going on here? We actually take ourselves away, because we're already here. It's already thus. And this is the case at every moment. But then within this, yeah, now there's things we can do. And you can invite me to come and speak, and I come and speak, any other number of things can go on here now that don't necessarily bind us or lock us into confusion. But when we start to think, but this is the right way, this is the best thing to do, or I really want that to happen, just watch your mind. Realize what you're doing there. And this is not necessary. But in learning to do this, and not taking hold of, as if to control, the great way appears clearly. Without disguise, it's not looking like there's something you need to do about this, or that it has handles on it somehow that you can grip it in some way. You can't grip this. I don't have any ideas about this great way. Whatever I probably had in the past, I've even forgotten that now. Because I realize this moment I try to form something here. In fact, in the early days of my writing, when I started getting some inkling about this, and I made the mistake, which I now see a lot of others doing here now, who are beginning to realize that the real foundation, the basis of all of this is mind or consciousness itself. It's not matter-based, it's or brain-based, it's mind. When I first started to realize it, I realized it pretty quickly. It wasn't like starting. And I knew better than this, but I wanted to say something to help other people to wake up. And I actually wrote a couple of books even where I never published them, where I got quite a ways into it, where I realized here I'm building a structure here, you know, my theory here and building a form that show how everything fits together and stuff like that. And I realized this isn't working. And I also, what finally came to the fore in my mind, it was there all along, really, but it wasn't, because I was still gripping, so I was still trying to bring about some result here. And with an honest heart, I mean, I wanted to help people. And I knew, we can't do this. There's nothing we can do in that way. But there's other things we can do. Eventually, I ended up working on the book that became my first book, How the World Can Be the Way It Is, which is the wrong title for the book. That's the title the publisher gave it. Because I'm not telling you how the world is the way, because the world isn't any particular way. That's what I thought I was pointing out ultimately. But that was based on a question that a group of physicists and philosophers who had met at Notre Dame, I spoke of it in that book, they were there to understand how the world can be the way it is, with all of the perplexities and things that were going on in, say, in quantum mechanics at that time. I won't get into that stuff, though. But the world does appear clearly, but as soon as we can set down our agenda, the thing that we feel we have to bring about, the ideas that we have connected with it. Because when it comes to ultimately what's taking place, whatever ideas you're holding are delusional, and you don't realize it. But in just setting this down, then the great way, it just appears clearly. It always does, but it's our own thinking that keeps getting in the way. Yes, a hair's breadth of difference. Yeah, so even the least little bit, drawing distinctions here and placing one above the other or whatever. Often we can leave it neutral too, but when we do that, hair's breadth of difference and heaven and earth are set apart. We go to the extremes, and we are always operating out of the extremes. When reality is this wholeness, it includes the extremes, but there's a lot more than just the extremes of is or is not, or this is good, this is bad, this is good, this is evil, you know. But we spend our time caught up in those ways of thinking. But a hair's breadth of difference, yeah, immediately everything is set apart. And if you wish to see it, if you wish to just wake up and see it, this is what you can't think it or grasp it or get ideas about it. We can see it. We do. You actually do see this already. This seeing it is your perceptual experience. I would italicized this seeing if I were writing it, because it's not like seeing an object or seeing an getting an idea. Oh, I see what you mean by that. It's not like that, where there's an object there of some kind, whether it's mental or physical or whatever. But just truly seeing. So it's because that's the conceptual. We have our perceptual experience of seeing immediately, directly what is taking place here, and we turn it into objects. And we set them up against each other, and there's where all the confusion and the pain and suffering enter into the picture, which it doesn't need to be there. Originally, it's not there. So this is just seeing, just leaving it to the perceptual. And we speak in a way that encourages our confusion, because we say, like, well, I perceive this chair. We'll talk that way, and it all makes sense to all of us, and I understand, you know, what you mean by that and that sort of thing. But actually, if you look very carefully, we don't perceive objects. I perceive color, I can perceive, well, perhaps shape. Actually, even that's getting into the conceptual, though. But the perceptual is the guarantee that this is not nothing. But as for the formed things now that seem to be appearing, this is our conceptualizing mind putting these things together. It's through thinking and explaining to ourselves in some way what this is or what that is. And if we can't explain it, because it's an optical illusion or whatever, and we say, well, our brain is fighting with itself, trying to figure out, is it this way or that way? And, you know, the Necker cube, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and we keep looking at it all in that way. But actually, what's really taking place here is immediately here. There's nothing you can say about it, because as soon as you say something, we're off. We're locked, you know. As the Zen master said, now you're locked in your confusion here now. And or if you think something, you know, so it's not like getting the right idea. This is why I have teachings like with Dogen, where he says, cease from practice based on intellectual understanding. you know, following words and chasing after speech. Isn't that how it goes? Yeah. Well, why would they talk this way? Like the other Zen master said, as soon as you stir your mind, you know. Yeah, well, pay careful attention to that. And then realize what you're doing. Again, it doesn't mean you absolutely don't stir your mind or something like that, because we do. Like, you know, for me to accept your invitation and come here, or whatever else, to cook dinner, you know, any number of things. So it isn't like that's bad or evil, but don't be carried away by that. But we'll stir our minds in such a way that we obscure the whole picture. And we'll follow after speech and stuff like that, too. That's why, too, we'll have teachers such as myself, say, Suzuki Roshi, to disappear in his Zen Man Beginner's Mind, where he says of his talking, he said, when my talking is over, your listening is over. Yeah, maybe the thinking didn't really need to be occurring at all, really. But your listening is certainly over. And then he says, there's no need to remember what I said, you know. And I remember when I first read that, I thought, well, what's the point of listening to you then? Isn't it for me to get some ideas about this or whatever? And yeah, but he's saying no, you know. But you should listen to stuff like this sometimes, a little bit. But don't grasp it. Don't try, because as soon as we grasp it, we derive meaning. We make our own meaning out of it and that sort of thing. Well, and if we can make some sense of it, out of it for ourselves, yeah, then we feel better, you know. But actually, this is delusion, you know. Whatever you put there is illusory. But if you think that, this is it. Awakening is not like that. Enlightenment is not like, I see it. All that's really seen with enlightenment is delusion. And you can't even have enlightenment without delusion. But it's finally recognizing what delusion is, seeing what it is. So now we don't have to keep stepping at it, or certainly not at least getting caught by it. But when we don't, then we may have some glorified, I don't know, can't quite picture it, but just some wonderful thing of what enlightenment is. Yeah, just drop that. It isn't anything particular at all. But it's clearly just realized, just this, you know, the great way. So, you know, how else did that go on? I suppose I don't have to finish commenting on everything that I said at the beginning. Well, could I repeat it? The great way is without difficulty. There's nothing it prefers. Only when you neither love nor hate does it appear clearly without disguise. A hair's breadth of difference in heaven and earth are set apart. If you wish to see it, then hold no opinions either for or against. Yeah, to set what you like against what you dislike. Yeah, don't we do that? To set what you like against what you dislike. Look at our political world today. You know, just going at it like this. And what helpful and healthy way of living is going to come out of too much of this? But to set what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. Look at that word, disease, dis-ease. That's what this is, it certainly is. This is the dis-ease of the mind. It's not an awakened mind, it's not an enlightened mind. And then we disturb our original peace of mind. Original mind is very peaceful. But we disturb this original peace of mind to no purpose. And it goes on, perfect like great space, the way has nothing, lacking nothing extra. But I could spend forever on all these lines here, so I'll just stop now. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to. Yes?
This sense I have is that we're, from an intellectual point of view, focusing on relative reality versus ultimate reality. But that's false.
Yes, very good observation.
As soon as you say reality or you say ultimate, you're dealing with concepts. Mm-hmm. And you can't take comfort in an intellectual analysis.
Ultimately, no.
You, leads you into a dilemma, because ultimate reality is not ultimate reality. It's not conceptually grounded.
Right. It's the other way around. The conceptual is in ultimate reality. Ultimate reality is not to be found in the conceptual. Except, of course, the conceptual is an aspect of ultimate reality, because the ultimate reality includes everything. There's nothing outside this.
And includes nothing.
Now, that's an interesting question or statement. I'll just let it go at that. As soon as we enter into something like nothing, yeah. But there's nothing we can say about that. Nothing. But we can say, and what I say is that obviously this isn't nothing. Do I want to say there's no such thing then as nothing? No, that would be going to an extreme. So I want to avoid these extremes. But we get to a place where words don't work. They're limited. But we often feel that we should be able to say this somehow. You know, we can get to this place where there's nothing to say. But I think a quick way out of the, what can I say, the black hole of nothingness is just simply to realize that, can't say there's a chair here. It looks like there's a chair. So, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to stand up and just start walking as if there's no chair. So it isn't that. But ultimately, is there a chair? Now we even know there's just recent breakthrough, as I mentioned, that physicists and mathematicians now realize that they don't even seem to have space or time. Well, then what is this with the chair in front of me? But the awakened have known this. I mentioned to you, I think, last night, that with Wang Po over 1,000 years ago, and he said there's only the one mind. Of course, he also realizes in saying it, he's speaking in Chinese, but in English, we're speaking anyway. And he realizes that whatever he puts into words here isn't it either. But ultimately, yeah, there's only the one mind. Okay, and that, now this isn't even an ordinary one. When I write it out, I'll capitalize that O for one, and then mind, capital M. Yeah, because it isn't like one as opposed to two or three or many, you know, or something like that. There's only the one mind. So this one is used in a radically different way than we might otherwise use the one in counting or in calculating or whatever. But get rid of that in the end, because nothing to say there. And we can say mind. Yeah, with a capital M, though. Not like my mind or your mind, our personal mind, our egoistic mind. This is mind, you know. That's what Wang Po is saying, just us. But again, nothing to say. Even to say that much. In the end, there's nothing to say. Well, here's your nothing, I suppose. But that's used in a relative sense. You know, because it's used in this world of, conceptualization, you know, in the conceptual world, in our intellectual grasps of things. And again, these things are not bad or wrong, but be careful with them and realize their limitations. But we'll use these things and allow them to just immediately carry us off to the extremes, and now we're living in a battleground where the actual reality is quite peaceful. You want to have your mind live in accordance with that, or in a way that's relating to that. Yeah, that's when I say watch your mind. And what to watch for? Just notice the leanings that'll appear. We can see this. This is what we need to do. And that's really about it. Now, this practice, we sit down and steady our minds, and that, yeah, it's very helpful in that way. Yeah, but if we think, well, I'm going to do this now so I can get what, understand what that is. That's more calculating now, grasping. I didn't say do this so now that you can get that. That's the way we'll put it together. We've taken things off to the extreme again. So what this is start to recognize when this is occurring in your mind. That's what this practice is. And then we can let a lot of it drop. The stuff that we do, because we appear to be these bodies moving around and interacting with all sorts of things and whatever. Okay, so we have to act and speak. Yeah. But we can do this in a careful way, you know, kind of a non-grasping sort of way, a non-insisting, you know, and without obsessing so much over me and saying, oh, and I'm going to die someday, and all the things that go with that. Yeah, all of these things, if we see what's taking place here, you realize that you're granting substance to these things just by taking them up and carrying it on as if they had substance. But you'll never find that substance. But this we can see. This is what awakening we can wake up to this. And this is, you know, we can say that, yeah, there are awakened people. Yeah, but as I said last night, you're not going to get a hold of any. But by the same token, there's deluded people too. And you're not going to get a hold of any of those either. You know, you start to recognize you're not going to get hold of anything here. Still, there seems to be people. Some seem to be deluded, some enlightened, maybe. Well, I don't know, can you say that? None of them are persisting as whatever it is we're going to label them as. You know, some of you say this person's enlightened, well, but they do a very deluded thing right now. Because in a moment there, we kind of momentary lapse or whatever, or not even momentary, but and vice versa, the deluded person suddenly just realizes this brilliant thing, actually says something that might be very helpful, maybe to that very person, him or herself, or to other people. You know, it's all very fluid, but what we can learn to do is be awake to it and don't try to grasp it. Except for the things that you have to do. At some point, I'll probably have to move, or somebody at least will have to move this. Well, I can still get up and around it, I suppose. But you know what I mean? We'll have to get up and leave this room. We're not all going to sit here forever now. Count off which one goes first and next and, you know, stuff like that. Well, we probably wouldn't last too long without at least water. You know, so. Yes?
I'm struck by how much of a struggle it is for most of us to sort of come to what you're speaking about. You know, as adults, you know, we're all here doing this thing and having a teacher come and speak to us and remind us of these things, and it's wonderful. And I live with a household of a lot of kids, and I'm just like realizing like how early that conditioning starts, mm-hmm. you know, of being taught you are you.
Yeah.
It's this identity thing. Yeah. And all the, and then I'm there parenting, reinforcing all of that, you know, mm-hmm. when they're getting into fights and being like, you are doing this and you're doing, you know, and it's I'm just amazed at like how deeply conditioned.
Oh, sure. But that's all necessary, I think. I wouldn't be too worried about that. It's kind of like we have to go through these stages of development, you know, and where we start to, you know, think in these terms. But at some point, we'll start to calcify out various things, you know, my sense of myself and other sorts of things. And as we move on into, say, our adult years and whatever, we end up being kind of frozen as images of ourselves and all sorts of other things as well. This, I don't know how old your children are, but sounds like they might be still too young to point out some of these subtle. They first need to form an ego to realize that actually, you know, you really can't get hold of that thing though. And that has to come later. But at the same time, don't over-exercise their ego or you know, build it up or something like this. But it will form, and I think it needs to. And it isn't like we shouldn't have an ego or we drop the ego or whatever, but we can start to realize that it actually doesn't house anything, it doesn't hold anything. But there's times when we still have to act with that. It's when we get into egoistic acting, you know, and I'm doing this for myself, or, you know, Now we're going way too far because we're doing this around some illusory thing, you know, and maybe bending everybody and everything in our life to our way, you know, that sort of thing, and getting further and further from realizing that, you know, you're doing all this for nothing at all in particular here, but it's causing an awful lot of pain in the world. But these things can come a little later. But first, that sense of self, you know, like I say, I wouldn't do a lot to try to strengthen it too much, unless maybe the, you know, everybody's different, every child would be different. But if they have nothing, they're just a pushover or whatever, or they'll follow along with anything anybody will say, well, I'm going to watch for those kinds of things as well. But it's, again, it's a matter of just not going to the extremes, you know. So I wouldn't worry too much about, you know, and too, at an early age, children do need direction. So for you to, well, you can say, order your kid to do this, well, yeah, but you can do it in a way that seems a little more loving than that, perhaps. But all of this is necessary, you know, so I wouldn't worry about that too much.
You want to keep them from walking out on the road when a car is coming.
Yeah.
That's. I was thinking about the harsh words we had for our kid. That was it. Stop.
Yeah, you know? Right. Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, it was a pretty gentle relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, once in a while, yeah, there's that moment when you might have to give a harsh word or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. But again, if you're watching your own heart and mind, you know, then you realize, because if you sense now, I'm really angry at this kid, you know, and you know, even if it's your own child, you know, see if you can refrain from acting out of that, with that mind, you know, and get back to being the loving parent. But you have to stop doing that, you know, whatever it might be at that time, you know.
Well, the anger in that particular instance, I'm not a parent, so I don't know, but the anger is not just anger, it results from fear and concern.
Oh, sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yes.
Risking getting too conceptual. I'm really interested in what you were saying about the Chinese language doesn't mention they that are unbiased or whatever. It's like, how does that couplet come out without the them, they, there?
Well,
can we translate that, or do we have to learn Chinese to hear that?
It gets kind of thrown in. I mean, the Chinese can't express something like that, but I think I used to be able to decipher Chinese. I studied Chinese for a while, and I learned how to use a dictionary and all that. But if you look very carefully at those characters in the opening there, it's not saying the translation that we get of the Great Way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. There's no for those who, you know. It looks to me like, and I've studied with other scholars have pointed this out as well, what it really says here is that the Great Way is not difficult. There's nothing it prefers. And that seemed like one of the cleanest translations that I've heard of. That's not my translation either. That's one I got from somebody somewhere way back there. But I realized, and that opened up a much more subtle understanding that would be missed if we did put it into English as for those, because that's still encouraging us to hang on to our sense of self, and so I should not have preferences and this and that. Never mind that, because well, what are you in the first place, you know? But reality itself doesn't have, well, yes, that's what it is, and that's what doesn't have preferences. And why? Because it's the whole. Why prefer a window to a door or whatever, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah. And all these various breakouts of various things, they all have their place. It could be very functional, like windows and doors, but sometimes not. But that's where we can just watch. But again, we don't have to say one is better than the other. But they are, they'll show differences. That's a characteristic of the world of the conceptual. But it's always backed by the whole, totality. And ultimately, this isn't more valuable than that. Yes?
So I'm curious about our practice and sitting, trying to practice non-conceptual awareness and looking at the wall.
Mm.
And let's say we're, you know, temporarily, 5-10 seconds, not
creating interpretations, just the sensory images crossing. How do we know that this awareness that's present without conceptualizing isn't just, you know, neurons burning glucose? And what is there?
Well,
this awareness.
That's what we'll say. Hmm? That's the brain model of yeah. consciousness. Yeah. Which
well,
I don't buy, but
just the brain is idling. It's not doing mm-hmm. any particular processing or conceptualizing, but there is some. The lights are on. And how are we to? how does all the effort we've put into this practice, mm-hmm. trying to attain a state of?
Yeah, but don't do that. Don't try to attain anything.
Okay.
See,
yeah,
see
okay.
You've been practicing with a mistaken idea there.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
okay,
yeah.
I know what you're
so just remember that now when you catch yourself doing that again. Just sit there. Don't think. You know?
Okay.
Because I remember when I first came to this practice, kind of a very haphazard way for quite a while, until I really met a good teacher. And then, I had ideas about why I wanted to practice, you know. And I had ideas about enlightenment. What would that be? And, you know, and I had ideas of just improving my life in various ways or just calming down, you know. A lot of things I thought I could get from this meditation. My teacher would point out that, you know, none of this is, this isn't helpful. That's just an ordinary mind operating that way. Yeah, sure, I'll do this because I want to get that, and, you know. This practice is something unique. True Zen practice, a Shikan Taza, if you're familiar with that term. And it's just sit down. Mm-hmm. And of course, you don't have to sit down, even though it's Taza, Taza means to sit. But it doesn't have to be. My teacher used to talk about Shikan basketball or whatever, where you just you lose yourself and you're playing the basketball. You are one with not just the ball and the floor and the other players on the floor there, but it's just this whole thing going on at once, and you've forgotten yourself,
mm-hmm.
and you know. You can say, well, the hand knows how to dribble and shoot and all, whatever. Yeah, we'll talk like that. But that's also going to get us into some confusion. Just live it out and get out of the way. And we can learn to do this in all sorts of ways, but that's what Shikan Taza is, just sit. It's called just sitting sometimes. And then to think about, well, what my brain is doing, or, you know, the different synapses firing, or this and that, or I can guarantee you that is all delusion.
Sure.
Yeah. And well, don't believe me, but but just sit down and just pay attention, just live this out. And when you have to get up and do something, then you just get up and do it. But then do that purely. The Shikan basketball, Shikan doing the dishes, whatever it might be, writing the contract, or I don't know what you do, but you know, whatever it is that comes your way, and then just take care of that like that. That's what we're practicing. But if on top of that we're thinking, okay, well, I'll really get good at this if I, you know, just keep this up. Well, yeah, maybe there might be what we might call improvement or this sort of thing. But you don't have to be even thinking about that, or attempting to use it, or feeling, boy, I'm getting somewhere. But in another 10 years, you know, I might really be, you know. Because this isn't something like that. I can't tell you what I've gotten from this practice. I don't even see in these terms anymore. On the other hand, I'm very grateful that I found this, and I have practiced it now for over 50 years. I don't know how long. That's more than that, though, I know. And again, too, it's not even that. Like, oh, I've done this a long time, but just pick it up and do it. It took quite a while for me to learn to stop having ideas about what it was I was doing or what I was expecting to get. Just, it's sort of like giving up. I've said it this way. It's like giving up, but don't quit with this practice. At some point, just whatever it is you think you're doing here, just give it up, give it up. But don't quit. Then you can learn to just sit there. That's Shikan Taza. You know, if we truly give it all up. That's again Suzuki Roshi when he said, when I'm talking, you're listening. Yeah, fully engaged with that Shikan listening. And when my talk is over, your listening is over? No, it's over. And whatever else now is coming up that you're facing or dealing with, just fully take care of that without a lot of ideas about what it is you're doing or what you're getting out of it, or just keep it very clean. And you know, but if we have to learn to do this. I mean, we can't just automatically start doing that, but realize it to move in this direction, you know. But again, even that's very tricky there too, because now you're doing that with intent and purpose. And these are the things that we have to learn to just kind of let them go. So usually it takes a while, but there's some point where we will really see what's actually going on here and what we're doing and how we can avoid the delusional parts, I guess. So I don't know if that helped or not. But
I think it's a question about what's the candy, this delusional mind that we're stuck with, and mm-hmm. recognizing the suffering, and then just sitting seems to offer some hope or something, a way free.
Yeah,
and
you can see it that way.
I'm starting to chase the candy.
Yeah.
I get it, but...
Yeah, if we don't need candy. Yeah, my teacher used to talk about Zen candy, you know, and there's all sorts of things out there, but we don't need candy. He said, I don't want to feed you candy.
But
candy will make you sick.
Isn't this endeavor to sit and practice itself a preference?
Well, it could be, certainly, yeah.
Because mm-hmm. there's certainly people that prefer not to do this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's definitely a preference.
Yeah.
There's very few people probably that prefer to do... I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know, just gotta get comfortable with the paradox of things, I guess.
Yeah. But never mind those people. Just watch your own mind. And if you got ideas about this practice, that's fine. Then it just means you got ideas about this practice. But you can understand that these ideas don't amount to anything, really. If you keep feeding them, they could start pulling it around in various ways. Now it might amount to something, but if you don't feed them, they'll kind of even come and go and maybe just drop away altogether.
All we can do is watch the leaning of our mind and eventually it settles down. And it does.
I wouldn't even hope for anything.
Right, my own personal observance, things do settle down.
Yes, but, exactly. And that's it right there. Is that by watching this, things will settle down. If you try to make them settle down, you won't succeed. Your very trying is stirring things up again. You know? So it's at first it's kind of difficult. So how do I engage this wholeheartedly and fully, and yet I'm not really working towards something? At first it seems maybe even impossible. So that's the thing about, like I said, just give up. Because this is one of the things I felt that I finally realized, this is what I'm doing. I've kind of just given up on pretty much everything. And yet, I still continue to practice. Even with things like, well, why am I even practicing? Those thoughts would come through my mind. They used to have more weight when I still thought I was doing something, but eventually I started practicing free of that. But still, such thoughts would come drifting through. But they don't really have any weight with me now. I'll say that, and yet now tomorrow I suppose it'll come through actually pulling something, you know. So I don't know. So I've kind of learned also not to comment too much on how I'm doing and that sort of thing. I remember early on, well, maybe not too early on, but having a lot of trouble with sleep in Zazen. And I really seemed to be struggling with that. And I would try different things, like I wouldn't eat before Zazen, or because that would just make you drowsy, because it's pulling blood toward your digestive system and away from your brain. And there's the brain will come in. But, so I would do different, and I'd make sure I was getting enough rest. At least I tried to, you know. In my younger days, it was hard for me to really get a full 8 hours or anything. But still, so I was making those efforts, and nothing was working. And this went on for like 2-3 years maybe, I don't know, where I was really just struggling with drowsiness and Zazen. And then at some point, all of a sudden, it just sort of seemed to drop away. And I didn't seem to have any trouble. And I'm starting to think, wow, that's pretty good. Man, I got over that hurdle. And, a couple years later, I was back into the, and I kind of learned from that is to just stop commenting on how am I doing? I don't know. I mean, and I really don't do it now. It's been so long, I don't even really think in these terms at all anymore.
Like, I'm really good at this.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
You get a star or something.
Yeah.
But last night there was a comment after your talk that made me kind of think about this. We have people here with a broad range of exposure to sodas, and mm-hmm. I mean, Chris is committed his life to it, to people that maybe are just starting to come around and do this and mm-hmm. have other traditions. A fellow last night said he was from the fruit salad school of Buddhism. And what he explained was like, I like Thich Nhat Hanh, I like Tibetan, I like Zen, and I don't mm-hmm. want to have a preference on that. You know, it's like this Soto Zen, and particularly the pared down version that you've built, just resonated with me immediately. So I have a great preference for this.
Yeah.
But if, regardless of your tradition, Buddhist or not, mm-hmm. if you can see that the Great Way, Buddha Dharma, has no preference mm-hmm. in that, that's what you're seeing. Can you comment just on what difference does it make?
Well, it can, in the world of differences, the relative world, mm-hmm. or conceptual world, it can make a great deal of difference, actually. So be careful in these areas, Because there's, like with my book on meditation, the Swedish version of it, when that came out, I thought whoever designed the cover of this book never read the book. On the cover was this beautiful Swedish blonde lady, and wearing a looked like a man's white shirt or something like this. And several buttons undone here, but I mean, it was covered, but and bare legs hanging over a dock on a placid lake with mountains in the background, and then she was sort of, and her cup of Javalia or whatever was sitting next to her there on the dock, and then she had her hands like this with forming one of these mudras. And then her head thrown back, and her eyes were closed, and everything was wrong with that picture. Like every detail was. And because often I'm consulted on the cover, but in this case they didn't, and so they sent me the Swedish version when it came out, and I took one look at it. It took me a while to just adjust to that. Anyway, where was I going with this? What was your question again?
There's all these different ways to the top of the mountain, and there has to be different teachings to fit different
people. Oh, yeah, right. Well, so whoever designed this was picking up on a lot of different ways maybe meditation is taught, and some of these things might be perfectly fine, but other things can get, and some of the things that were displayed on that cover of that book were, they weren't just simply not what I'm teaching, but in some ways these things will encourage you to go off in directions that in the book I would tell you be watchful of and be careful of, mm-hmm. So it isn't like anything goes. Really what you want is, and this is what I have in my book on meditation, is just make it as simple as possible. That's what Katagiri Roshi used to say too. He said the only three things you need there is body, mind, and breath. You bring these three together with the meditation. Anything else, things will come and go in the meditation, but you don't have to do anything. Take care of your body, sit in an alert as best you can in some kind of a posture that helps you to stay alert. And then there's your mind. Watch your mind. Don't do anything about your mind, but watch it. And of course, the breath is there. And what's interesting about the breath, I think I discussed this in the book, I'm pretty sure. But breath is, so you have mind and you have body. Breath is something right in the middle. It's sort of unique in this way. I think it's unique because I've looked for decades now trying to find, is there anything like the breath? And there isn't. And what I mean by that is the breath is both the subject, it's me, you know, I can control it. I can breathe in all kinds of ways. I can hold my breath when I'm diving underwater or whatever. And, you know, very few mammals can hold their breath. Do you know that? We are one of the few. The aquatic mammals can, obviously. But and there's a few others. But most animals, dogs and cats, they can't hold their breath. But we can do it rather easily, unless we have some kind of impairment. And so we can be very conscious of that body function and control it even, easily. Try to do that with your heart or your liver, you know. These are sort of on automatic pilot there, and the body's taking care of that with no conscious connection there. Well, to some degree, I've been able to capture my heartbeat, but to control it, not anywhere near, not even close to like what I can do with my breath if I need to. So it's kind of like it's in the subjective part, where I have full control, and it's also automatic, like this recorder I have here in front of me here, that it's just there. I can't, you know, with my mind get it to move or do anything, you know. But the breath is like right between these two worlds of the me and the not me. Very, very good place to put your mind, right there. But don't do anything with it other than just be aware of what's happening. The Buddha speaks of this. He talks about being aware of a long breath. With a long breath, be aware of a long breath, a short breath. But whatever the breath is doing, don't try to control it, but just watch it. With some control, maybe, see if you can breathe from the diaphragm, so the breathing is a deep breathing. But I wouldn't make too much even of these things. But just it's the awareness that is absolutely critical. The awareness without doing anything, without trying to control, without thinking about what this breath is or what it means, or am I doing it right, am I doing it wrong. Sometimes people will get so focused on their breath that now they can't even breathe in a way because they're overthinking it when you don't need to be thinking about it at all. So just kind of let it be, because it will be out there just like your heartbeat is just out there. You're going to breathe no matter what. At the same time, you can easily find the breath, unlike your heartbeat. It takes some doing. Liver function, I don't know. Can you get that far in to see what? But with the breath, it's right there. So just kind of learn. That's a good place to, you know, your mind will leave that for a bit. And that's the beautiful thing of it, because you don't stop breathing just because your mind left. You'll continue to breathe for the next 20 minutes, even though you never thought about your breath during that time. But when you notice that, just come back to that area. So it's like, it's me, I can control it. And yet at the same time, I can totally forget about it. So it's like it's not me at all, and it's off somewhere else. But there it is, I can find it, as it, like an object. So it's right in that object-subject space, which is, by the way, illusory. But that's the place, because everything formed like that is illusory. But that's a very good place to hold it. It's just the slightest, don't try to hold it there. I don't mean hold it, keep your attention right there.
Here's breath.
Hair's breath. But that hair's breath, will, you know, you'll see that opening up. It'll widen. And yeah.
One of the things that new meditators are taught is to watch their breath. If they, you know, new to Zazen, new to meditating, one of the techniques is to bring it back and to count. And
count.
Can you speak a little bit about the impediment that might be? Because from what you just said, and then I could take it, extrapolate it out a little bit further, because shikantaza is considered to be kind of a more advanced form of meditating.
Yeah.
At least that's the way it's somehow.
More subtle, I would say. But.
And it's a bit of a hoodwink, because when you...
Shikantaza.
Just sitting. So when we learn shikantaza, all of a sudden we're taught to just drop all the light, whatever happens, happens, in a way. That's sort of one way of looking at shikantaza, but yet, as a new meditator, and we're going through, we're taught to look at our breath, and if we fall off the cushion, so to speak, we pick ourselves up, we bring ourselves back to the breath. Whereas shikantaza tells us, if you fall off the cushion, just recognize you fall off the cushion. I'm using that as an aphorism for we just sort of lost where we were. Can you speak to that a little bit? The impediment that the breath can actually be in watching it, if
we're serious about meditating, if we're serious
yeah.
about it, yeah.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, with beginning students, I would say pretty much what I've said to you here. But and I didn't mention Shikan Taza, which isn't particularly helpful for new people. But in time, the whole thing about staying with the breath, yeah, you let that go too. You know. But what I said here, though, the breath is an area that's, if you are wandering around all the time, it isn't Shikan Taza anyway. It's you're wandering around.
Right.
Bring it back to the breath. Yeah. But in time, that becomes less and less necessary. Yeah. But I don't really talk about that much because I think people kind of automatically go there. But if you say, hey, just let it all go, people aren't ready for that. Because just letting it all go, you'll find that. That'll come of its own. And there's no instruction for that, really, but that will come of its own. The instruction probably be nothing more than, yes, there is this possibility that you'll realize at some point. But if I plant something there and say, well, this is something to aim for, now there's trouble there again. So the breath, do I follow my breath? Not really, no. Even though I instruct kind of in this way. Am I aware of the breath? Yeah, very often. You know, it's one of the things that'll come up in my mind. But do I force myself to stay there? No. But I'm usually there anyway. Mm. Yeah. So that's a good point you brought up there, Chris. Because people can get fixated on the breath. But that's the thing you're watching is don't get fixated on anything.
Right. Yeah. And that was my point. I mean, we use it as a technique, but mm-hmm. it's still getting fixated on something.
Yeah.
You know, we're still separating myself now from the breath that I'm not watching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's, in the end, it's just avoid all techniques. Mm-hmm. But at the beginning, you kind of need.
I think it's invaluable at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I think so, yeah. Because otherwise you don't know where or what you're doing. Yeah. So this will just help you stay steady. But that's the location is between the subjective, objective sense of what's taking place here. Breath is unique in that way. Like I said, you can find it easily, and at the same time you can forget it. It's still there. You know, if you have a candle flame that you're looking at, well, now you can really get fixated on something. And, but the breath will wander away. You know, so it's helpful in that way. Then the rest of the part that you were concerned with there, with the Shikan Taza, or the just Shikan living, and that kind of comes of its own.
Mm.
It's helpful to mention that, I suppose, that there is such a thing as this. But it isn't a matter of not go look, because if you say it too early for people, they're going to start going looking for it. And, oh, it's just Shikan, and stuff like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you almost have to just only mention it once in a while, but don't say too much about it.
Mm.
No, but then my teacher took Katagiri, and he'd say, for some reason, he always used basketball, but Shikan basketball. but just kind of letting, this isn't just you sitting on a cushion. Your mind can function in this way, with anything, really. Well, I would say with anything wholesome. And that's a whole other.
Can I ask it? I had a question about the Shikan Taza versus the breath thing. Because you said it comes about naturally, the Shikan Taza, or it can. But do you think that sometimes
it comes about of its own? I would say naturally, it's like it's bound to come about. I don't know if I would say that.
Well, do you think that sometimes though that people need the permission to allow it to come about because they've been following the breath so long, they'll just keep on the breath?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. That, and I've had students come to me and they've done many years of say counting the breath.
Yeah.
And that's not helpful. That could be helpful at the very beginning when you can't even hang on to your breath. But you want to let go of that as soon as you can. You know, and don't count. Other times, people, too, they'll count up to, 30, 50, 100, whatever. But the simple way is just simply to count up to 10. And do you have any idea why? And then start over again with 1 and count up to 10 and come back to 1. That helps to keep your mind on what you're doing. But there's one other element to it. Do you have any idea what it might be? Those numbers between 1 and 10, except for 7, are all single syllable. So it's just this single syllable, 1, 2, 3. Because you get up to 34. You know, it's so there's a reason for going to 10 and starting over. Because I remember at the beginning when I first heard that, and I thought, well, why would you start over? You get to 10 and then you start over. Well, yeah, because as soon as you get to 11, then, you know, 12 is the one, but after that, multi-syllable. Anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.